You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I am Larry O'Connor. Jesse Jane Duck, Gunnery Sergeant for the United States Marine Corps, sitting in for Brian Wilson, who is on vacation. Good to have you, Jesse.
Good morning, motivators.
And Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and all that stuff. It was a Merry Christmas, except the headlines coming out of this holiday weekend in cities like Chicago were depressing and disturbing, to say the least, as over 60, I think what the final count was, 67 people shot in Chicago, over 11 people killed. Violence, major urban violence popping up on what is supposed to be a quiet holiday weekend.
Right.
And we're seeing this trend often, and we want the American people want to fix this problem. We we're at our wit's end. We don't understand why it continues to happen. And we like to turn to people who seem to have answers. Sheriff David Clark is the sheriff of Milwaukee County in Wisconsin. And Sheriff Clark, you seem to have some answers on these things, so I appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you, sir. So I don't know if you can sum it up in a nutshell, but when you look at that kind of outbreak of violence and death in Chicago, what first comes to mind? I know a lot of people in this town, they say, oh, there's too many guns. What do you say?
Well, this isn't a gun control issue. The left will always try to make it that this is a human behavior issue. But the thing that's most stunning to me is the lack of a sense of urgency coming out of the White House, coming out of Loretta Lynch's Department of Justice. They see the cop as the enemy instead of the criminals. They've been consistently going after police departments with these crazy consent decrees. They have been attacking the character, the honor, the service of the American police officer instead of going after the criminals. This is easy to fix. We've done it before. We had record levels of crime reduction all across America in major cities, including Chicago, New York, L.A., Milwaukee, Washington, D.C., the Federal District, when we did what works. We got away from what works. That's what the problem here. We just have to do what we've done in the past. We don't need any new creation. No more crazy ideas out of academia, some inane social engineering program to try to rehab criminals and all this other nonsense has to stop. We have to go back to using jails and prisons as an effective crime control tool. As we sit here and talk about this, President Obama has commuted the sentence and pardoned more people just in the last 6 or 8 months and during his 8 years than any other president. So, you know, this is not that difficult. But, of course, the way that I talk and what I want to do right now gets a lot of resistance from the left, who's gone soft on the criminal element.
Good morning, Sheriff. My question to you is, you've had dialogue with Donald Trump on these topics. What do you feel that he will make first as a big impact to help situations like in Chicago? What ideas does he have, and what do you see him doing moving forward?
Well, first of all, kudos to Donald Trump. He is the only candidate. I don't mean in the general election. I'm talking about in the primary as well, the primary elections. To choose a candidate. He's the only candidate that put a spotlight on these hell holes in the American ghetto, all run by Democrats in these cities all across America. So the first thing you have to do is recognize it and admit it. And that's why I said the silence on this from, you know, the White House, from Mr. Or President, I should say, nothing to see here, Barack Obama, move along. And Loretta Lynch, from his adopted hometown, for heaven's sakes. I find it quite remarkable. I find it quite astounding. So, but Donald Trump, the first thing he did was he said, hey, we got a problem here. That's the first step toward fixing anything, whether it be your health, whether it be your car engine. You recognize something, you know, the light goes on. You can't ignore this stuff. You got to say, hey, we got a problem here. We got to start to address this. So he did that. Now, that's step one. Step two is he started to support the work of the American police officer who are on the front lines of this stuff, who have to go out on a daily basis, put their lives on the line to protect and serve their community. The White House and President Obama has been an echo chamber for this hateful ideology called Black Lives Matter. Speaking of Black Lives Matter, where is Black Lives Matter? Why aren't they in Chicago protesting the black-on-black crime? The violence. Why aren't they protesting in Mayor Rahm Emanuel's house, demanding that he do something, put together some sort of plan to regain control of the streets and to stop the violence? Think about this. Nearly 800 people killed this year in Chicago, murdered, I should say, in Chicago alone, and over 4,000 people injured by gunfire. Think about that. That's more than the cities of L.A. and New York combined. This I find staggering. Yet, where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post? Where's CNN? Where's the Huffington Post? Where's MSNBC? They should have satellite trucks in the city of Chicago, daily reports on the violence, demanding that Rahm Emanuel do something, demanding that the governor, who's a Republican, by the way, newly elected, demanding that the state attorney general step in, demanding that the Department of Justice step in and do something to end this violence. But again, if you look at the statistics, above 80% of these murder victims are black. So we're talking about black-on-black crime. There's some dysfunctional cultural behavior that's going on that would cause somebody who you're having a dispute with to pick up a firearm and shoot you with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just I've been at this for 39 years, folks. I've seen a lot. All right, I'm in an urban center myself, Milwaukee. We have high levels of violence here. So I'm not from some small town or some rural area where I don't see this and I don't recognize it. I do, but again, I've been providing the pushback here in Milwaukee as we release longtime criminals, as we have gone soft on crime here in the Milwaukee area. And you know who pays the biggest price for that? Not the professor in the ivory tower who comes up with the social engineering project, not the mayor, not the attorney general, not the council member, the common council. No, good law-abiding, poor black people, brown people,
yeah.
The elderly, they pay the highest price for going soft on crime. So
yeah.
I think the selection of Jeff Sessions to be the next attorney general, boy, I'll tell you, I was doing somersaults when I heard that because he supports the police. He's done it as the attorney general in the state of Alabama. He realizes we have to lock these career criminals up. All this nonsense, the myth of mass and black mass incarceration, which doesn't exist. You know, he doesn't believe in any of that crap. He's going to get in there and use because these are local issues. All right. The White House can't solve urban crime. The U.S. DOJ cannot solve it. But they have resources that they can lend the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago and Milwaukee and New York, where murder's up again as well, Baltimore. And they can use the federal code to send these career criminals for gun offenses, for being felon in possession of a firearm, for street robberies, for these sorts of things. Send them to federal prison, not state prison, federal prison, for long periods of time. And by the way, Barack Obama just created a lot of space in the federal prison with his commutations of federal sentence.
To the crime that we saw in Chicago over the weekend. Is there racism there? I mean, I'm the last person to shout racism. But when you're concerned about a white man shooting a black person, but you say nothing about a black person shooting a black person, it's almost as if you're saying, well, we can't expect them to do any better mm-hmm. than that. This is expected. I mean, after all, they're incapable of not killing each other. Am I jumping in conclusions here, Sheriff Clark?
No, not at all. You know, the lowering of expectations for some of this behavior when it comes to my people, black people, is astounding. This would be, these expectations should sit well with any race, with any people, any demographic, any gender. Human behavior is human behavior. There's acceptable standards of behavior, and there are unacceptable standards of behavior. But the problem is when these liberal elites, and that's who they are, and that's why, I named the New York Times, the Washington Post, the mainstream media. When I look at them, I look at academia as well. You know, I know who the suspects are in this. Liberal academia, when they look at, especially academia, when they look at a black person, when they look at a black community, what they see is a social engineering laboratory. Mm-hmm. They look, and this is the racism that I think, where I think it plays a role here. They look at the ghetto and they say, there's a social engineering laboratory where we can try experiments. Like, black people are lab animals.
Mm.
Hey, let's try this experiment here. Let's try this program, this over here. And then when a program explodes, because it will, you know, they just kind of, yep. Oops, and they kind of walk away, and no one's held accountable for this failed program. So, you know, I look at this and I say the true racism is on the left. When a Democrat Party looks at a black person, they see only one thing, a reliable Democrat vote at election time. Other than that, they don't care about those people.
Sheriff David Clark, we have to leave it there. We could talk to you for hours and would love to do so sometime, but at this point we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, though.
Thank you,
Sheriff. It's
great
stuff. And I know the people of Milwaukee County don't want to share you, but we would love to see you have a role in this administration and come to the nation's capital. Hopefully that'll happen.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us right now, Noah Pollack, columnist at the Weekly Standard and an expert on Middle East affairs and specifically issues regarding the state of Israel. Thanks for joining us, Noah.
Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas
and happy Hanukkah as well, and happy New Year. Boy, what a horrible Christmas and Hanukkah present it was for the state of Israel. It happened on Friday, this vote at the UN where the U.S. abstained. Yeah, can you take us back a little bit? Because I think a lot of people were in the holidays. They weren't paying attention, which I think was part of the design here. Last I heard, Egypt had withdrawn their petition for this proposal before the Security Council. What happened?
The thing about Security Council votes is that you can get any number of other states. There's 14, there's permanent members of the Security Council, and many of you are rotating members, and any of these members can sponsor a resolution. And so the resolution ended up being sponsored by four other countries, including such great moral heavyweights as Venezuela, Singapore, et cetera, and they sponsored this resolution. The Obama administration was lobbying these countries behind the scenes to do so. And the resolution passed easily because the UN is sort of a star chamber for Israel, and any anti-Israel resolutions there will automatically be passed. And so the Obama administration decided to join in the bullying. And this resolution was passed easily with the United States abstaining, which is the same as a yes vote.
And what's so bad about this resolution?
It's just so crazy because what it does is defines all land over the 1949 armistice line, which is the line where it's not a border, it's the line where the end of the war that the Arabs started when Israel declared statehood, the guns fell silent and you had an armistice agreement that's not a permanent border, and it declares all land over that line to be Palestinian territory that is being illegally occupied by Israel. This land includes the Western Wall. It includes half of this city of Jerusalem. It includes the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem.
Insane.
So this is it's offensive, actually, to declare, you know, the Western Wall, which is really at this point the de facto holiest site in Judaism, to be illegally occupied Palestinian territory. It also is a total contradiction to what Obama has been claiming for 8 years to be his true beliefs about how to achieve peace and about his support for the peace process, that he supports negotiations, that he supports the two parties negotiating. He supports no such thing. He supports bullying Israel and pressuring Israel because he's never actually pressured the Palestinians to negotiate. And here he is going to the UN and doing an end run around what he had been claiming to be for 8 years to be his actual beliefs about the need for negotiations. You have hundreds of people who knew that the Obama administration was lobbying the Security Council to pass this resolution. Obviously, Israeli diplomats and government officials have friends in these countries,
mm-hmm.
and they simply told the Israelis, by the way, you know, the Obama administration is lobbying us to support this resolution. That's all that happened. It was like someone, you know, two guys ran into each other in the hallway.
Is it true, Noah Pollack, that this basically is identical to previous resolutions that the United States, even under President Barack Obama, have rejected, voted no on? So, and if that's true, what is their rationale about this new policy of an abstention, which, as you said, is the same as voting yes because it allows the resolution to get passed?
It has been a longstanding U.S. practice. The last time this was really violated was in the Carter administration, to veto grossly unfair U.N. Security Council resolutions against Israel, which pop up every few years. You know, there's a country will sponsor them and they'll gain some momentum. And the United States smacks them down because the U.N. Security Council is not the place to be conducting diplomacy with Israel. It's a grossly unfair and biased body that's dominated by Islamic State.
Mm-hmm.
These are all like reasons why America does this. And the Obama administration in this case decided that they would not do that. And so it's interesting to see how the administration kind of messages this, because on the one hand, they'll claim, they claim two contradictory things. On the one hand, they claim that this was no big deal and this has happened many times before and it doesn't really matter. And then they also claim, well, this is actually a very big deal because, you know, Israel's behavior is so repugnant that we had to do this. And you see how they're kind of hiding the ball by having this contradictory messaging. Yeah.
Well, since Egypt has been one of the only countries, the only Arab country to make peace with Israel, and they did decide to withdraw from supporting this, but weren't they behind this resolution?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's tough for a country like Egypt because Egypt has what's known as a cold peace with Israel. They have a peace treaty The relationship between the two leaders, between Sisi and between Netanyahu, is a very, very good relationship. And the relationship between, you know, the kind of elite levels of the military and security services and intelligence mm-hmm. is very, very good. And there's elaborate cooperation. The problem is just that, you know, the Egyptian public is very anti-Israel. Mm. And so the Egyptian government kind of gets stuck. You know, they on an official level, they have a very good relationship, but then they end up getting, you know, kind of forced through public opinion, essentially, to do these types of things, you know, to say these anti-Israel. And this is a common thing in the Arab world where you'll have leaders who privately will acknowledge that, you know, they have no real problem with Israel, but publicly, to kind of placate anti-Israel public opinion, well, they'll say these silly things.
Trump administration had helped pull that in, too, I believe. They had mitigated with probably President
Egypt,
El-Sisi.
But as Noah said at the beginning of our interview, there are sadly many other players. It looks like the cantina scene on Star Wars there at the Security Council, and they found somebody else to propose it. Noah Pollack, Weekly Standard, thanks for joining us.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
We're going to talk to Joe Concha now. He is the media reporter over at The Hill. And, well, Joe, you're a reporter. So if you hear that the subject that you're going to be covering for the next 4 years thinks that you are dishonest and the most dishonest as a member of the political press, well, how do you approach your job on a day-to-day basis?
I don't change a thing, Larry, to be honest with you. I mean, let's put it this way. Let's say Hillary Clinton had won, as every pundit, every pollster said what happened. How do you think she views the press? Because I have a feeling it's the same exact way. Trump just has no filter, so he says it. But I would think that most politicians are very wary of the press, particularly the political press. It's more about clicks now. It's more about ratings. It's more about generating sensationalism and making things go viral and being first instead of accurate. So I think that most politicians, most public figures probably have a disdain for the press. Most of the American people do. Trump just happens to say it, and he says it without a filter, and he says it without apology.
When you think about the political press here in Washington, D.C., it's almost like they have two goals on a daily basis. One of them is really not part of their job, and that is to be liked, to be popular, to be invited to the right parties, and to be thought of being on the right side of things politically. The other job that they've got, it really is what they're paid to do, which is to get information, report the information, get access to politicians. For the latter there, I would think that a President Trump would be a godsend. He's been so open, so accessible, and has given them so much to write about compared to Barack Obama.
Well, how do you mean by accessible? Because it doesn't mean via press conferences. He's nearly approaching 150 days on that front.
True, in terms of your traditional press conference, but certainly we saw during the campaign, I mean, nothing stops him from picking up the phone and just calling directly into a television show and doing a lengthy interview. And also, I mean, no, he hasn't done a formal press conference, but he certainly, during the campaign, would stop and give reporters bits and pieces as he went on. And again, you said he's unfiltered. He gives you great quotes.
Yeah, I wonder if that will continue, that scenario that you laid out, that was very apparent until maybe July before the election. Yes, he would call into every show, and every show loved to have him because he was a ratings magnet like we've never seen before. But towards the end of the general campaign, he basically only did interviews on Fox News and Fox Business. And all the other shows, whether it be CNN, whether it be ABC This Week or CBS This Morning, he avoided.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's going to continue. Maybe at that point he felt he needed them more than they needed him. But now he definitely knows that the media needs him more than they need. How am I trying to put this?
Yeah.
I'm trying to say that he has the leverage now, and it's going to totally be on his terms in terms of when he does interviews, which I don't think will happen terribly often, and press conferences, which may not happen very often as well.
What about the team he's assembled? Sean Spicer has a pretty good relationship with the media in this town, a long relationship. He's been with the RNC since before the presidential election of 2012, and Certainly, I would think, compared to Josh Earnest, he's seen as a more straightforward, straight shooter kind of, I'll tell you the way it is and not just spin you kind of guy.
I was surprised, Larry, to be honest with you, that the press secretary sweepstakes went on as long as it did. I always thought Spicer was the best choice and basically the only choice. And we're hearing, you know, Laura Ingraham from Fox or Kimberly Guilfoyle from Fox, and they're fine. But Spicer, that always should have been his job. So, yeah, I think that he'll be obviously doing daily press briefings. I don't think that's really an issue. I heard that was going to be, well, maybe those are going to be ditched and then no one's going to do them anymore. No, of course he is. And straight shooters, when you become White House press secretary, that tends to change. You have to. I think it's the hardest white-collar job in America, honestly. And with Donald Trump, when you have to defend every tweet, you may be walking at a podium with the perfect plan, and Trump tweets something out 3 minutes before you go on that you barely even been briefed on, and you have to defend it. So, Godspeed, Sean Spicer. It's going to be the toughest job you have ever had.
You know, I know you're based out of New York, and you report on the media in a great way, by the way, Joe Concha. I love the way you cover the media, and you cover it the way we're all experiencing the media. You're not inside the media, necessarily. You're covering it as an observer, just like we are all observers as we're watching it on television. But being down here in D.C., sometimes I get to go to events, and one of the unspoken little secrets down here is that the media, the press corps, even though they agree with Barack Obama and love his politics, they've actually had a pretty hostile relationship with this White House press apparatus, from the conflicts over the exclusive photographer of the White House and not giving pool photographers access to the president and to White House events, to some of the more troublesome aspects of tapping the phone lines of AP reporters and James Rosen through the Justice Department. Is it true, from your observations, that the media actually, on a working basis, doesn't really like this president?
No, that's absolutely true. They don't voice it as much as they do with the apocalyptic prognostications as far as Donald Trump. Like, oh boy, the press is going to be in trouble, and what about our First Amendment rights?
Yes.
But here's the thing. Barack Obama set the record pretty much into his seventh year, so he had a full year before he had even had to set this record of most rejected FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act requests, than any other president. He has not been transparent. What he did with James Rosen was beyond despicable as far as spying on him. Not only him, but his parents, and hacking the email. Not him personally, but his Justice Department, obviously.
And Cheryl Atkinson. And I mean, it goes on and on.
Yeah, and you just didn't hear about it quite as much. I always love to do the parallel universe type of close your eyes and think of it this way. What if Donald Trump had done that to a CNN reporter?
Yep.
His Justice Department and hacked emails and basically spied on him, or with AP, as you mentioned, just as bad. So, Barack Obama leaves beloved, but secretly people are saying, yeah, he wasn't the greatest guy to work with, and certainly not like a Bill Clinton, that's for sure.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch, and it'll be interesting to watch you watching it, Joe Concha, over at The Hill. I appreciate you joining us and giving us a bit of a preview in what I think is going to be one of the more fascinating dynamics of this new administration, the relationship between President Trump and the media. Joe,
thanks for the kind words, by the way. I mean, obviously that Boone Strawberry Ale that I sent down there, somebody got it, and
yeah,
I appreciate it.
We're ready for our next shipment. You know what? We're not supposed to joke about such things on the radio. There are laws. So,
kidding. Well, trust me, Boone Strawberry Ale is anything but a bribery.
Just kidding.
No, I'm kidding. It's a wonderful wine. I shouldn't say that about those folks. And the fact that it comes in a box is even better.
Happy New Year, Mr. Concha.
All right.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us right now is Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto to talk about the year that was in entertainment. Hey, Christian, Happy New Year. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Well, I think it's impossible to not look back at 2016 in the world of entertainment and not focus on story number one, which is, sadly, how many people died. Not just people, but legends, Prince, David Bowie, Glenn Frey, George Michael, and of course, just in the last several days, Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher. It's a remarkable story, isn't it, Christian?
It is. I mean, these are people, listen, Debbie Reynolds was in her 80s and she suffered the loss of a child, and at least that makes some sort of sense from an organic point of view, but my goodness, David Bowie and Prince, you know, Bowie started the year, and we just were shocked by it. We never even thought about him as being ill or anything connected to his situation. So it's been an awful year, and it kind of grew into this sort of social media meme, who's next, and it basically ended with a GoFundMe account for Betty White trying to save her from 2016.
Yeah, Alan Rickman, Gene Wilder, Gary Shandling, Muhammad Ali, Nancy Reagan, and do you think that this is just sort of the phenomenon of Gen Xers and baby boomers just sort of reaching an age where, you know, there were so many celebrities, Hollywood became such a big deal, I think, or sort of became such a big part of our culture during the 60s and 70s, that now the people who, you know, came of age and were popular actors or musicians at that time, they're just getting older. And when you get older, you die. So is this going to be something that we're going to maybe see in the coming years? This is the new normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think social media basically magnifies everything. And also, like you said, it does point to these actors, these singers, they mean so much to us. I know that sounds silly because we have our lives and our families and day-to-day activities, but they impact us. I mean, you just look at social media in the last few days over Carrie Fisher's passing, and people are in genuine mourning, and we're reaching out to each other. So as much as social media can be a disturbance, it can be weird, it can be kind of creepy at times, it also kind of has a communal spirit to it as well. And just the fact that we're all reaching out and kind of connecting, I think it's a good thing overall.
Looking at the top grossing movies of 2016, and I know, Christian Toto, over at your website, Hollywood and Toto, you focus on the cinema a lot because, well, frankly, you're a really good film critic. You look at the top films, Captain America, number one. And then number six was Batman versus Superman. Number seven was Deadpool. Number eight was Suicide Squad. We're going to have superhero movies in our lives for many, many years to come, aren't we?
We are. You know, it's funny. I guess for years we've been reading the superhero burnout is coming and we're getting exhausted. No, we're not. It's not even remotely happening. And even mediocre movies like Batman versus Superman score. And frankly, I thought Suicide Squad was terrible and they made a lot of money. So more are on the way. 2017 will not change that at all. And frankly, I have no problem with that. Listen, we love blockbusters. We love popcorn movies. That's the kind of movie that sells these days. And, you know, it's good versus evil. They've got colorful characters. And they're doing them well. I mean, Captain America Civil War was just a darn good movie. And it had interesting themes about government overreach and liberty. And it wasn't hectoring. It was just entertainment with a little bit of thought in there. And so it's hard to disagree with that.
One other trend, and listen, one thing about Hollywood is whatever worked last year, they'll try again next year because they don't have new ideas, right? Listen to this. I noticed this trend in the top highest grossing films for 2016. Captain America Civil War, and I'm doing this in order, okay? Captain America Civil War, Finding Dory, Zootopia, The Jungle Book, Secret Life of Pets, Batman versus Superman, Deadpool, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Suicide Squad, Doctor Strange. That's the top 10. Then you hit Rogue One, which of course is only a couple of weeks old, The Mermaid, X-Men, Kung Fu Panda. I know that on the surface it looks like, oh, well, these are all animated features or they're superhero features. There's more to it than that. They're not about real people. They're not about reality. I'm down to 15 now, and all of these movies are fantasy movies about talking animals or about science fiction and fantasy. What does that tell us about us as a culture that we aren't migrating toward movies that are actually grounded in reality?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I mean, this was an escape year. The economy still hasn't really come roaring back like we hoped it would. The kind of the presidential election speaks for itself. I also think it talks to how TV is much better at telling these human stories, about kind of the interconnections as well. And I think maybe the films have kind of just said, okay, TV, you do all these great stories with these real gritty characters. We're going to do the razzle-dazzle because we do it better than that. So I think that's part of it as well. And also, it's, you know, movie stars don't sell tickets. It's brands. And brands aren't often, you know, Fred Smith from Idaho who's got an accountant business. It's about a guy who has superpowers. So I think we just are drawn to these sort of overwhelming otherworldly themes as opposed to the more, I guess, naturalistic stories.
Well, you mentioned how TV is better at this, and they are. I mean, I think we're living in a golden age of television, but we're sort of redefining what television is. It used to be ABC, NBC, and CBS, and, well, later Fox. But really, television is anything on any device that really isn't a movie. Talk about how streaming content and the money that is going to Amazon Prime and Netflix to create original content, what that has meant to the the quality of that. You would think it's oversaturated, that the quality would go down, but I believe we're living in a time where the quality is the best it's ever been.
You're right. It's an amazing to watch, and a lot of the cases, it's not just throwing money into it. I think one of the things that TV and the streaming channels are doing right is they are letting the actors and the authors and the showrunners do their thing. One of the things that happens in movies is there's, you know, screenings and test screenings, and the studio agent heads, you know, send along their notes, do it more like this. You've got to please these different demographics because there's so much money on the line. Well, the TV shows can do niche programming and do it better, and they're not really relying on all those notes and all that fear factor built in, because the money isn't as extreme as with the Captain America Civil War. Because if Captain America Civil War tanks, they're losing so much money. That isn't the case with TV. And again, I think when you let the actors and directors just do their thing unencumbered, you get better art. And that's what we're seeing. It's competition. It's, you know, everyone realizes you can't just put out a show these days. If you put out a mediocre show, there's a million better shows, and you've got off your game.
Christian Toto, the website is HollywoodInToto.com. And despite the name of the website, it's not just about an 80s band and the dog from Wizard of Oz. There's a lot more there. Christian, always good to talk to you, sir. Happy New Year.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Good morning, sunbeam goes far through. Good morning to you and you and you and you. Good morning,
I can't tell you how many times I've been tempted to open every hour of Mornings on the Mall with this song. It's the ideal song for a morning show. And, of course, I have a bit of an affinity to fantastic show tunes. But today it's more appropriate than ever to hear the voice of Debbie Reynolds alongside Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor in the movie that put her on the map and made her an instant legend. Debbie Reynolds died yesterday afternoon, and what a tragic ending of her life as it came 24 hours after the death of her daughter, Carrie Fisher. It's horrible to imagine. Yet at the same time, there's a bit of, I don't know, sweetness to the fact that a mother seeing her daughter pass away felt such agony for the loss of her child that, according to reports, her last words were, "I want to be with Carrie." Here's Debbie Reynolds talking about her daughter to Oprah Winfrey, and especially considering how she passed away yesterday after hearing the news of her own daughter's death. These words are incredibly moving and haunting.
I would say that Carrie and I have finally found happiness. I admire her strength in survival. I admire that she is alive, that she has chosen to make it. It would have been easy to give up and to give in and to keep doing drugs. I always feel, as a mother does, that I protect her. Who will do that when I'm gone?
Well, she protected her right up until the end, and then her job as mother to her daughter, Carrie, was complete. And so we lost her yesterday. Here's Carrie Fisher reflecting on her mother. Who better to eulogize Debbie Reynolds, than her own daughter?
The funniest thing is my mother goes on the road and works. She gets up and puts her face on and her hair on, and she's just this, she's alive at a time in her life when a lot of people are getting ready not to be. My mother is bigger than ever. I believe my mother knows now, but if she doesn't, it would be good if she did, that I take her advice, that I follow her example, that I respect who she is. And I'm glad that if that I'm like her in any way, I'm very, very happy that I am.
And how wonderful that Debbie Reynolds was able to hear her daughter say that. Apparently, Debbie Reynolds used to have Carrie sing, and the two of them would sing together when she was a child quite a bit at clubs and sometimes even on stage on Broadway after the curtain call when she was performing in Irene. They sang this together just for about 30 seconds during this segment, but then the two of them broke out together with Carrie Fisher taking the lead vocal on, well, a great way to remember these two.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. So let's sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together.
Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher, rest in peace, mother and daughter. Rest in peace together.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM, WMAL.